Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of why the Republicans are determined to enact unpopular measures like more tax cuts for the rich, immunity for big corporations, bankrupting the post office, and forcing states into bankruptcy, instead of going along with popular programs like giving relief to states, localities, frontline medical personnel, and workers. Dr. Jacob Hacker, a professor of political science at Yale University and co-author of American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, and his forthcoming book, Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in an Age of Extreme Inequality, joins us to discuss his latest article at the New York Times, Republicans Think They Can Get Away With It. They Might Be Right. The leaders of the governing party can't seem to stop doing and proposing unpopular things. With the Republicans finding all sorts of way to throw money at Wall Street while shortchanging Main Street, as they continue to resist helping the 40 million unemployed and protecting workers from the coronavirus while trying to force states into bankruptcy, we'll assess why they are doing it and whether they will get away with it. Then we'll examine the tense situation in Minneapolis following the killing of a black man by a white police officer who kneeled on the man's neck for 8 minutes until he died, ignoring the man's pleas that he could not breathe, and the concerns of onlookers who begged the police to ease up, calling out, "He is human, bro." David Schultz, a professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota Law School, joins us to discuss why rioting against police brutality in Minneapolis is likely to get more intense and how this incident might sink Amy Klobuchar's chances of being picked as Joe Biden's running mate. Then finally, we will speak with Sarah Posner, a reporting fellow with Type Investigations, about her new book just out, Unholy: Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. She joins us to discuss Trump's recent pandering to evangelicals demanding churches be reopened and the alliance Trump has forged between white nationalists and white evangelicals, as well as offering insight into why the religious right turns a blind eye to Trump's outrageous lying, as though the eighth commandment, "Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor," no longer mattered. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. Which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now, Dr. Jacob Hacker, who's a professor of political science at Yale University, an expert on the politics of U.S. health and social policy. He's the author of a number of books, including Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, and the forthcoming book, Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in an Age of Extreme Inequality, each of those co-authored with Paul Pearson. And he also has an op-ed with Paul Pearson at the New York Times, Republicans Think They Can Get Away With It, They Might Be Right. The leaders of the governing party can't seem to stop doing and proposing unpopular things. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Jacob Hacker.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it is puzzling why Mitch McConnell and Trump, and McConnell in particular, seem determined to give tax cuts to the rich. And McConnell's number one priority, before he'll give any more money to Americans who are running out of food and money with 40 million unemployed, his priority is to give big corporations immunity. What he wants to immunize them against is that they're not taking care of their workers and protecting them, like in meatpacking plants, where they get sick, but nevertheless, they won't be able to sue. So these programs are very unpopular and forcing states into bankruptcy. So it is hard to understand why they'd be getting away with it. And you have given me some insight here. So where do you think we'll be in November? Is it possible that unpopular programs could win, beat out popular demands?
Well, I mean, I think if we have a free and fair election in which there's broad participation, there's a very good chance that Republicans are going to suffer a major electoral rebuke. And, you know, I mean, Republicans, you know, try to shovel money to rich people is a real dog bites man story at this point, right? We've come to expect it. But in the midst of a pandemic that's laid bare American inequality, and that is also, I think, neglected fact is that it's also drawn Americans together in support, as you said, of a few key bipartisan ideas like helping out the states and localities and you know, protecting the post office and making sure that we are cautious as we reopen and have adequate testing, which most Americans see as a federal responsibility. So in this context, when people are supportive of you know, a substantial majority of people are supportive of a particular approach. Republicans aren't just failing to pursue that approach. They're pursuing policies that are wildly unpopular. So that, to us, that's just a huge puzzle. It's you know, one thing for Republicans to pass not very popular tax cuts in 2017. It's another thing for them to do so in the midst of a pandemic as a presidential election looms. And so our goal in this piece, drawing on our forthcoming book, Let Them Eat Tweets, was just to try to scratch down and understand what's going on. And you know, we think some of it is strategic. They're seeking concessions. Some of it is, you know, hoping that public opinion will swing around to the positions that Republicans are advancing. But I think the biggest part of it is that Republicans actually really want to do the things they're doing and not do the things they're resisting, and they think they might get away with it.
Well, they've already actually gotten away with it in the CARES Act. Buried in the CARES Act is close to $500 million give away to corporations, and particularly real estate corporations. So it's already happened. I'm sorry to tell you.
But here, yeah, no, I mean, there's two meanings of get away with it. The first is, of course, actually, you know, pursuing and achieving these policies. And you're totally right that to a striking degree, Republicans have gone to the mat for the rich in these recent legislative rounds. And we could enumerate all those elements. But in the deeper sense, get away with it in a democracy means that you are able to face the voters at that ultimate moment of democratic accountability, election day, and the voters have a say on your program, and you are put back in office. And I think the Republican theory of the election at this point is that they will be able to sort of pull out their two big bulwarks against accountability. One is the tribalism that they've built up within the Republican Party, so that you know they're going to gin voters, you know, the base of the Republican Party up into a frenzy of outrage. And the second is all the ways in which Republicans have kind of rigged an electoral system that's quite vulnerable to rigging, whether it's extreme partisan gerrymandering or the kinds of voter restrictions that we've seen on vivid display in Wisconsin in the pandemic election, and more recently in the lawsuit against California for seeking to send all registered voters absentee ballots in the fall. You know, so. Or in the tweets of speaking about let them eat tweets, in the tweets of Donald Trump that argues that there's going to be massive voter fraud in the fall if people are allowed to vote remotely. So I'm just worried that they may be right. And I think our piece wasn't trying to reach a judgment on whether or not Republicans can actually get away with it in that deeper sense of win in the fall, that is, you know, capture the White House again and, you know, hold on to the White House and hold on to the Senate majority. But we were arguing that Republicans have a theory about how they're gonna survive. And it's a theory that should really worry us because it essentially involves undermining social solidarity and undermining democracy.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Jacob Hacker, who's a professor of political science at Yale University and an expert on the politics of health and social policy. He's the author of a number of books, including American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, and the forthcoming book, Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in an Age of Extreme Inequality, co-authored with Paul Pearson. He also has an op-ed with Paul Pearson in the New York Times. Republicans think they can get away with it. They might be right. The leaders of the governing parties can't seem to stop doing and proposing unpopular things. Now, of course, President Trump is something of a political Houdini. People thought it was all over for him when the Access Hollywood tapes came out. Then they thought that the Mueller report would do him in, and then the impeachment. And now he's managed to politicize the pandemic itself as a way to distract from his bungling and making it a kind of culture war issue. Just yesterday, he accused a reporter who was wearing a mask of being politically correct. It is amazing, is it not? At least it is to me, Jacob, that this president has this ability to fight back, sometimes with the most outrageous lies imaginable, and yet somehow holds on to his support.
Well, yeah, but let's be clear about what holding on to his support means, right? He's held on to roughly 35 to 40% approval rating, occasionally gone above that. But unlike leaders in other rich democracies who forthrightly took on COVID-19, he hasn't seen a big bump in approval as a result of the pandemic. And indeed, he's been drifting downward. So he has certainly been able to bring the Republican Party behind him, and he has clearly very very good record, shall we say, of defying the odds, not least in 2016. But it's one thing to not get impeached or not get convicted when the Senate is in Republican hands. It's quite another to win in a high turnout election when you've pursued a set of fairly disastrous policies that most Americans recognize to have not worked. And that's what he's facing. I mean, the most optimistic take on this, if you think he should be held accountable, is the 2018 midterm elections, right? Where no matter how many times he talked about an immigrant invasion, he saw the House decisively shift into Democratic hands, despite some pretty high firewalls against, or bulwarks, as I've named them, against that. So I think that the chance that Trump will lose, and the chance that Republicans will lose substantial seats in the Senate and maybe even their Senate majority, since it's so close, has gone way up as a result of these horrible events. But at the same time, that means that the imperatives, the incentives for Republicans to try to undermine free and fair elections in the fall have gone way up as well. And of course, in the midst of a pandemic, the opportunity to do so might be greater as well. And the thing that is, I think, genuinely worth reflecting on, and what we are really focused on in this op-ed, is that they're not even sort of following the two sort of basic imperatives that one would think you would follow right before an election, which is at least try to do a few some popular things and try to avoid doing really unpopular things. And at least when I started to look at the polling data, I was just really struck by the extent to which there's actually a fair amount of convergence. You know, there's a angry minority, that is against, that is skeptical of public health, against mask wearing, thinks that we should immediately reopen the economy, hates Anthony Fauci, whatever, right? There is a minority out there like that, but it is a distinct minority. You know, 2/3 say the post office should be rescued, 2/3 say there should be aid for states and localities, 2/3 say that we shouldn't be favoring the wealthy, 2/3 or, you know, these are all sort of approximate, but roughly speaking, you know, 2/3 are in support of a cautious reopening guided by public health experts. So I think it's a sign that this crisis has created more agreement among Americans than you might think. And yet here we are watching a party that seems hell-bent on rejecting what bipartisan majorities demand and demanding what bipartisan majorities reject.
Well, just in the last few minutes, though, you do explain in your op-ed why it is that Trump and McConnell are defying conventional politics and the rules of electoral survival. And the answer is that they are totally in the pocket of the plutocracy. And
That's
not
right.
just the plutocracy, but the right-wing plutocracy, or the white wing of the of the plutocracy, the Mercers and the DeVosses and the Kochs. And that's more important for them to be, you know, loyal hirelings of plutocrats than it is to serve American democracy.
Yeah, no, I mean that. So the core argument of our book, Let Them Eat Tweets, is that the Republican Party's increasing embrace of plutocracy and as inequality has skyrocketed in the United States has driven a lot of the other aspects of the Republican Party that culminated in the rise of Donald Trump. So it is because the party wants to pursue unpopular priorities of the right-wing billionaire class and the most conservative veins of corporate America that it has had to resort to a series of increasingly, you know, tribalistic, divisive, and even racist electoral strategies. And, you know, that has been possible because in addition to the ability to play on these emotions and sort of make every election into an existential struggle for white Christian America, the party has benefited from the fact that as the voters that support it have become more and more located outside of urban centers, white rural America, they've benefited from a lot of the features of the American electoral system or the vulnerabilities of the American electoral system that have allowed them to magnify the strength of those voters. So in a lot of ways, what Republicans want to do today by riling up their base and then trying to exploit voter restrictions and partisan gerrymandering and basically every tool they have in their vote rigging toolkit is really an extreme version of what they've been doing for the last 15 or 20 years. And, you know, I just want to say that we really would like there to be a responsible Republican Party that is, you know, a full and equal opposition party or governing party in a two-party system. But that's not the party we have right now. And it's at the heart of a lot of the dysfunctions in our politics that we see today. And so as political scientists, we wanted to write this book so that people would understand the roots of the problem and then also some of the ways in which we might be able to overcome it. And alas, right now, you know, that dysfunction and its dangers are more present and more apparent than even we could have predicted when we finished the book, you know, at the end of last year.
Well, Dr. Jacob Hacker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, it's always a privilege and a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Jacob Hacker, who's a professor of political science at Yale University, an expert on the politics of U.S. health and social policy. He's the author of a number of books, including American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, and the forthcoming book, Let Them Eat Tweets, How the Right Rules in an Age of Extreme Inequality, each of which is co-authored with Paul Pearson. He also has an op-ed with Paul Pearson at the New York Times. Republicans think they can get away with it. They might be right. The leaders of the governing party can't seem to stop doing and proposing unpopular things. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the rioting against police brutality in Minneapolis is likely to get more intense and how the incident of another black man dying on camera might sink Amy Klobuchar's chances of being picked as Joe Biden's running mate. We are amazed but not amused by all the things you say. That are made by you, but we are sick and tired of hearing. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Schultz, a professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He's the author of 30 books and various articles on American politics, ethics, election law, and the media, most recently Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Election Law and Democratic Theory, and American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Schultz.
Thank you.
And David, you also have an article at the Washington Post Monkey Cage, There Is No Right to Vote by Mail. New lawsuits could change that. I'd like to talk to you about that, obviously. But let's start with what's happening. You're in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and there have been riots and tear gas fired at riots by police. People are responding to the hideous video that many of our listeners have seen of a white policeman kneeling on the neck of a black man down on his face, handcuffed. 8 minutes pass by while you literally witness the death of a man. It happens before your eyes, and in the background, bystanders are trying to tell the police that the man is... he can't breathe. He said he can't breathe. He's bleeding from the nose, etc. And they simply ignore the bystanders. So this is not the first incident with the Minneapolis police. And an Australian yoga teacher was shot and killed in the alley next to her home by a policeman. And a year before that, in 2016, Fernando Castile was shot by a Minneapolis policeman when he was in his car with his girlfriend, who recorded the incident. So what's the problem with this police force there in Minneapolis?
Well, a couple of things. First off, is that I used to teach at Hamline University in our criminal justice program, you know, about 20, 25 years ago. And I mentioned that because I follow this fairly regularly in terms of what's going on in Minneapolis, and there's a long history that goes back not just 1, 2, 3 years, not even a quarter century, but it goes back far longer than that in terms of the city of Minneapolis having, a real serious problem with people of color being shot by white officers with a significant amount of, or otherwise significant amount of excessive force. Now, the Fernando Castile case was actually a different city than Minneapolis. But if we still just focused on the city of Minneapolis, there's been a train of white officers shooting, assaulting, abusing people of color. And so it seems to be part of, if I can use the phrase here, part of a culture within the Minneapolis Police Department in terms of this excessive use of force by mostly white officers against people of color. And this has all types of implications, of course, not just locally but nationwide. But locally, Minneapolis is a city that not only has this disproportionate use of force against people of color, but it also has some of the worst racial educational disparities, healthcare educational disparities, incarceration disparities for people of color. And Minneapolis has a reputation of being a liberal city, but beneath that liberalism is an enormous racist racial problem.
Well, the mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey, who seems remarkably young, actually, he's come out saying the right stuff, right? He's quickly fired four of these police officers and just said that, you know, we can't simply have a situation where being black is a death sentence. And that's what a lot of people feel. And, of course, you've had the incidents down in Georgia with a man who was killed by a former policeman and his son And then apparently the guy that took the video is also implicated. Video, of course, is nowadays is the only way we learn about this stuff. So the implication is a lot of really bad stuff happens off camera, right?
Correct. Correct. And here, the police account initially would have been, had we not had it on tape, that what? They showed up to a report about somebody who supposedly was involved in forging documents or mail fraud or something. I can't remember what the exact allegation was. And their claim was that he was resisting arrest and they needed to use force. Well, it was, but for that cell phone capturing it, we might not have known what was going on. But even if we move beyond that, even if we move beyond what's being captured on tape that we're seeing now, or digitally, I should say, that we never used to know before, let's think about the factual circumstances of this case, which also makes it so hideous, is that they show up to a report about an incident that involves somebody who's not alleged to be violent. You know, we're not talking about, let's say, a murder or a bank robbery or something in progress. They show up. If you look carefully at the tape, they have a handcuffs on the suspect. He's by or next to the police car. There's at least one other police officer present, if not a couple of others. If the question were about, let's say, subduing him, they more than have him subdued. They don't need to choke him. On top of which, putting a knee on someone's neck, asphyxiating him, is never, never an appropriate method for trying to subdue somebody. So on so many different scores, there are many problems in what happened in Minneapolis.
And again, I'm speaking with David Schultz. He's a professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He's the author of 30 books and various articles on American politics, ethics, election law, and the media, and most recently, Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Election Law and Democratic Theory, and American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. And he has an article at the Washington Post, Monkey Cage, There's No Right to Vote by Mail. New lawsuits could change that. So where is this going to lead? I mean, you have, in spite of the coronavirus lockdown, people showed up to demonstrate and they were tear gassed, and it's become a ritual in this country, you know, and it's led to the birth of this movement, Black Lives Matter. And every day you realize that to many police officers around this country, Black lives don't matter.
Yeah, they don't. And this is the question about where do we go next? Because again, this is not the first incident where we wake up and say, my gosh, we never realized there were racial disparities in the use of force. We've known for a while and nothing seems to happen. And the logic was what was supposed to happen approximately 40 years ago when the Supreme Court said that police departments could be sued for civil liability under what's called 42 U.S. Code 1983. The idea was if we could now sue police departments and they would have to pay out, not out of their insurance, but pay out millions of dollars, maybe that would lead to police departments changing. Well, guess what? It hasn't. That hasn't changed at all. Hasn't changed practices. Additionally, what we know is that maybe one of the ways of changing police departments would be to hold these officers criminally liable. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has made it very difficult to prosecute officers in terms of showing that they used excessive force. Prosecutors themselves, including, for example, Amy Klobuchar, who used to be the Hennepin County prosecutor, which included Minneapolis, very reluctant to go after police officers. And juries are seldom willing to convict police officers if, in fact, they are indicted. So we have this, to use that phrase, we've got a systemic, a societal-wide bias that the current mechanisms of criminal law and civil liability have not worked to change police departments, and something fundamentally different needs to occur. And I think this is in part why it's perfectly understandable why Black Lives Matters is protesting, because it is clear what Black lives don't appear to matter at this point. And yes, four officers were fired at this point, but something far more fundamental is going to be required than simply firing four police officers. If we thought the riots on Tuesday night were significant, by the way, they're going to probably be worse over the next couple of days. On Tuesday night, we had torrential rain and still over 1,000 people turned out. But after what happened on Tuesday with the tear gas and everything, expect to see the demonstrations become even larger and more intense over the next few days.
You mentioned Amy Klobuchar, David Schultz. She, along with the other senator from Minnesota, Tina Smith, and Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Representative Betty McCollum, they have all sent a letter asking the U.S. Attorney in Minnesota and the Hennepin County Attorney to investigate the officer's actions. So is Amy Klobuchar sort of trying to rehabilitate her image there? I mean, if you say, she was a defender of the police when she was, what was she, the district attorney?
She was a district attorney for Hennepin County. Hennepin County is the county that includes Minneapolis. And at the time she was essentially district attorney, we use the phrase county attorney here, but at the time she was district attorney, she did not bring a single prosecution against a police officer for excessive use of force. And at the same time, and this is a story that came out last year as her presidential bid started, she was treating juvenile offenders as adults, cracking down heavily on drug crimes, and the racial disparities in Minneapolis, Hennepin County went dramatically up under her tenure. And when she started running for president, this record of hers came out. And so now, as she's being vetted by Joe Biden for vice president, I think she is probably increasingly worried that she might be perceived as part of the problem in terms of what's going on in Minneapolis for not holding police officers responsible.
So in the last couple of minutes, let's talk a little about your article at the Washington Post, Monkey Cage. There's no right to vote by mail. News lawsuits could change that. The president, of course, is going out of his way to demonize mail-in voting, to the point where Twitter had to put a correction on his tweets. And that's got him, Trump, now declaring war on Twitter and saying that they have a liberal bias and all that predictable stuff. So that's going on. And by the way, David, I don't know how this country can continue being led by a person who's clearly mentally ill. I mean, he yesterday, when he went on a rant about mail-in voting with absolute nonsense spewing out of him, he also went on this rant when he was asked by a member of the press about his attacks on Joe Scarborough, this horrible attacks, saying that somehow Joe Scarborough was responsible for the death of a young aide in his office in Florida when Scarborough was in Congress in Washington, D.C. The husband of the woman who died, apparently she had an aneurysm and collapsed and hit her head on the desk as she fell. It's a horrible tragedy. The widower has begged Twitter to take down Trump's terrible, insensitive and absolutely insane posts. And so far they haven't done it. But the long and the short of it is that this is outrageous, what he's saying. There's absolutely no truth to it whatsoever. But he doubled down yesterday. He went on at length at how this should be investigated and denied that there was any problem. And even when asked about how could he be so insensitive to the widower and the family of this young woman, and he said, oh no, they'll be happy when the investigation is done. It's unbelievable what a ruthless liar this man is.
Yeah, what he has done is several things. One of them is he panders to every racist, conspiracy, bigoted theory out there, and has given the respectability to all the worst prejudices that exist out there in American society. And with that, he's making it clear that he will do whatever it takes for him to get reelected, which means if it lies, it means cheats, if it means making up, in the case of the absentee ballots, an absolute lie that says that absentee ballots are not secure or they're fraudulent, even though we know we have incredibly overwhelming evidence that in the states that are using them, they are perfectly safe. The way I have described it is that we'd have a better chance of buying a Powerball ticket and winning it than showing that that vote by mail would have enough fraud to overturn an election in the United States. And that's not just conjecture. There's been repeated studies that have looked at voting in the United States, voter fraud, and have largely reached that conclusion. But he's afraid. He's afraid that if people actually show up to vote, especially this election, what's going to happen? He's going to lose. And so he is engaging in the worst forms of intimidation and voter threats. And at a time when people are afraid to go to vote because of the coronavirus, he's going to do whatever he can. Now, the one silver lining in all of this, even though what happened in Wisconsin back in April during the primary was a mess in terms of people getting sick, what it showed, though, is people were so angry that they still turned out to vote. And that, and not that I want people to show up to vote and put their lives at risk, but they were willing to put their lives at risk in order to cast a ballot. And that's the part that I think that scares the president.
Well, David Schultz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with David Schultz, who's a professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He's the author of 30 books and various articles on American politics, ethics, election law, and the media, and most recently, Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Election Law and Democratic Theory, and American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. And he has an article in the Washington Post, Monkey Cage, There Is No Right to Vote by Mail. New lawsuits could change that. We're going to take a restation break. We're back looking into the alliance Trump has forged between white nationalists and white evangelicals and how the religious right turns a blind eye to Trump's outrageous lying. And some might say that it's a waste of time, cause ain't no amount of dancing finna break the bondage. We go to war and transcend space and time, when every record ain't a record just to shake behind. You know the stakes is high, we in the face of drama. That's why we can't shake it or escape the problem. It's like a game of roulette, the barrel revolving. They only wanna see us occupying a coffin. Mothers crying too often from they lost child leaving. I'm trying to get over, get under, get even. Get inside, get into getting dumb, getting greedy. We got to get it right, it's not about to be easy. Come on. Burning Isaac, Jesus coming. Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in the second chance? Do you believe in rapture, babe? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sarah Posner, who's a reporting fellow with Type Investigations, whose investigative reporting has appeared in Rolling Stone, Vice, The Nation, Mother Jones, The New Republic, Huffington Post, and Talking Points Memo. Her coverage and analysis of politics and religion has appeared in The New York Times, The Washington Post, The American Prospect, Politico, and many other outlets. She is the author of God's Prophets, that PROFITS, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Value Voters. And her latest book just out is Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Posner.
Thank you, Ian.
So, Sarah, last night I was watching on television the president just lying in the most ruthless and outrageous way about Joe Scarborough, alleging that he had murdered his aide, and that there's a whole bunch more to that that's coming out. And when reporters tried to ask for specifics and mentioned that the widower of this unfortunate aide that died in Scarborough's Florida congressional office while Scarborough himself was in Congress, he said, oh, no, they're going to be very grateful when all the truth comes out. Well, there's just nothing to it. Everybody knows that there's nothing to it. And there never was. And it's a cruel lie. But he really does double down. So whatever happened in terms of evangelical support, whatever happened to the eighth commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor?
Well, as much as the Christian right likes to talk about the Ten Commandments and have them in public places, when it comes to Trump, they just simply do not apply. Lying, like you said, bearing false witness. None of this matters because white evangelicals have made their bargain with Donald Trump, and he has made his with them. And I think that there is very little, if anything, that he could do at this point that would result in a significant or meaningful dent in their support for him.
He did rather nakedly pander to the Christian right the other day when he called for the churches to be opened and said, you know, how come in a dig to California, how come you have liquor stores open and not churches?
Right.
That was seemed to be such a flagrant pandering, but it may be in response to his concerns about losing some support amongst evangelicals and white Catholics. The Pew Research Center released data just last week showing a 7-point increase in white Catholics who disapprove of Trump's response to the COVID-19 crisis and a 6-point decline amongst white evangelicals who were previously supporting him. So is he in trouble in spite of this extraordinary adherence to Trump from these religious people who seem to be in the same cult worshiping this heathen?
Well, so that question was about his response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And so he did lose support among white Catholics and evangelicals over his response to the pandemic. But I don't know that that poll tells us that these voters would then turn on him in the voting booth. There have been other times over the course of his presidency when his support or approval on a particular topic has dipped a little bit. But I think when it comes down to getting in the voting booth and voting for Donald Trump, who has appointed Christian right loyalists to high positions in his administration, has nominated the judges that they want, has given voice to their claims of being victims of infringements on their religious freedom. I think that question about whether he's responded appropriately to the pandemic does not get at the question of, once these voters step in the voting booth, are they still going to back him because of what he's done for them and the power and influence that they continue to wield during his tenure?
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Posner, who's a reporting fellow with Type Investigations, whose investigative reporting has appeared in Rolling Stone, Vice, The Nation, Mother Jones, The New Republic, Huffington Post, and Talking Points Memo. Her coverage and analysis of politics and religion has appeared in The New York Times, The Washington Post, The American Prospect, Politico, and many other outlets. She's the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Value Voters. And her latest book just out is Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. So when you mentioned the network of Christian right evangelicals, I guess, in the Trump White House, the positions that they filled, the latest one, of course, is fairly prominent, is the White House press secretary, who's a born-again, she wears a little crucifix, but she's lying. I mean, she said she'd never tell a lie, and then lo and behold, just yesterday, she told the most ridiculous lies about Trump's crusade, or jihad, I should say, against mail-in voting and against Joe Scarborough.
So this is just a continuation of the other press secretaries that Trump has had since he took office. They, you know, from the beginning, Sean Spicer lied for him. I think there were possibly maybe a couple of others in there, but the longest serving one was obviously Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who's the daughter of a Baptist preacher and herself an evangelical Christian, and she lied all the time too. I think the important thing to remember here is that Trump's support from the Christian right base is pretty unyielding in terms of, is he lying about Russia? Is he lying about political corruption? Is he lying about voting fraud? Is he lying about a whole, you know, from things consequential to inconsequential? And it hasn't mattered to them throughout his presidency. It didn't matter during his campaign, and it hasn't mattered even as he faced impeachment, as he's faced scandal after scandal after scandal. It didn't matter that he paid off Stormy Daniels, and it didn't matter that he lied about it. So we can have a conversation about whether that's truly Christian or not, but the truth is that the Christian right is interested only in this one specific portrayal of Christianity that's about their ability to define what Christianity is, what government policy and the law should be based on that version of Christianity. So we can go back and forth about whether that's truly Christian or not, but the point is that they see Christianity through this very specific and increasingly autocratic lens. And that is why they support Trump.
Well, that's the value of your book, Sarah Posner, Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump, because it is very puzzling. The hypocrisy is so naked. But it also applies to conservative Catholics. And in a, you could make the case that as much as there's a evangelical network in the White House in top positions, there's more of a key network in really important positions from Opus Dei types. You've got the two that, in effect, convinced Trump to take on William Barr, who's got ties to Opus Dei, Laura Ingraham of Fox News, and Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel. Their Opus Dei, along with Larry Kudlow, who was also recruited, Newt Gingrich, and all kinds of, and most of all, Leonard Leo, the guy that puts all these right-wing judges on the courts. So when trying to talk to people that know Barr, that I've interviewed, trying to figure out why is he doing what he's doing, again, the same hypocrisy. Why are you, a religious man who spouts authoritarian moralism, why do you support this man? And the only explanation I got was that these authoritarian moralists, like the Opus Dei types, they see their political crusade in this country can be best brought about via the judiciary. And if they get enough of their people like Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on the courts, then they can overturn Roe v. Wade, etc., and bring the country back onto a path of righteousness. So how different is the, do they work in coordination, these right-wing Catholics and right-wing evangelicals?
Well, the Christian right has always been made up of a coalition of conservative white evangelicals and conservative Catholics. I think that for a long time people had a perception that Protestants and Catholics wouldn't be co-belligerents together in this culture war that they've waged over the past 4 or 5 decades. But they've actually found, you know, common cause over the course of that time, not only on matters of like abortion, but also opposing LGBT rights, opposing church-state separation. And as I document in my book, basically opposing the type of liberal democracy that promotes pluralism and diversity and civil rights and human rights. And so in the book, I tell a fairly detailed story about, or history, about how the Christian right came to put abortion front and center. And it was the conservative Catholics who were the ones who opposed abortion early on, even before Roe versus Wade. And the white evangelicals were not that interested in the abortion issue. Maybe a few of them caught on to it early on, but the issue that really animated them into getting involved in national politics really had to do with civil rights. And they went into coalition with conservative Catholics who were against Roe v. Wade later on, more later in the 1970s, like around the time that the Moral Majority was formed in 1979. But before that, white evangelicals were very riled up about the Bob Jones University case, which was a case in which the Internal Revenue Service used its sort of power of the purse, so to speak, in taking away the tax exempt status of a school that had a segregationist policy, a policy of not allowing interracial dating. And the IRS had embarked also on this effort to ensure that private schools, including private Christian schools, had non-discriminatory admissions policies, because it didn't want the civil rights put in place by first Brown v. Board of Education and the Civil Rights Act to then be undermined by private schools then discriminating against students. So as public schools were being desegregated, the IRS wanted to ensure that private schools were not discriminating against Black students. And this was the issue that got white evangelicals very animated about national politics, because they didn't like the idea of the federal government telling them what to do in their Christian schools. So, you know, abortion is now at the top of their agenda, but the issue that really pushed them into the national political conversation and national political activism was pushing back against the government doing what they considered to be infringing on their religious liberty rights, which sounds a little bit familiar now as we're watching the churches complain that governors' stay-at-home orders, some churches complain that governors' stay-at-home orders infringe on their religious rights to have worship services.
Sure. Well, also the televangelists themselves promote this attack by the secular state against religious values. Particularly, they're very sensitive about tax exemption because they benefit from tax exemption. They're able to, you know, buy Gulfstream jets, etc.
That's right.
And obviously, I mean, I can't believe anybody gives money to these people, but they do, and it's just extraordinary. But just in the last couple of minutes, in an article of yours I was reading, you mentioned that the Trump's top evangelical advisor, Paula White, who's the advisor to the White House Faith and Opportunities Initiative, has prayed that any persons, entities that are aligned against the president be exposed and dealt with and overturned by the superior blood of Jesus. So I don't know the extent to which they're going to get down with the white nationalists, these gun-toting guys that showed up at legislatures in Democratic states. So, but you had an interesting and very important interview with Stephen Bannon at the Republican convention, where he admitted to you that their plan and their strategy is to unite white nationalists with Christian evangelicals.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the unholy alliance, is it not?
Right. So Bannon, who in that interview admitted to me that Breitbart is the platform for the alt-right, tried to dispute the obvious fact that the alt-right is a white nationalist movement. He tried to dispute that. But yes, he said that the alt-right could not win an election or even hope to enact its agenda without being in coalition with the Christian right, with white evangelicals and white conservative Catholics. Now, this is kind of the heart of my book, the heart of Unholy, because while Bannon admitted that, it wasn't like you saw the Family Research Council's Tony Perkins meeting with, you know, Richard Spencer or these very overt white supremacist, white nationalist, Hitler saluting alt-right people. But what happened was Trump was clearly, even before he started energizing the Christian right with his 2016 primary campaign, he was energizing the alt-right. They believed that he was speaking for, on behalf of, and in defense of white people. They loved his anti-immigrant policies. They loved his racist provocations at his campaign rallies. And while all of that was going on, evangelicals were, you know, evangelical voters, according to polling, were gradually coming on board with Trump, really seeing him as their defender too, somebody who was unafraid to push back on all this political correctness that they believed had been keeping them down or preventing them from having their religious freedom. And so over time, even as Trump did not display any biblical fluency or any of the litmus tests, passing any of the litmus tests that the Christian right had imposed on presidential candidates for decades. You know, you saw it in 2000 and 2008 and 2012. They wanted candidates to talk about, they wanted Republican candidates to talk about their salvation story, to talk about the Bible, to talk about how they would govern from a biblical worldview. And Trump didn't do any of those things. Trump doesn't go to church. Yet evangelical voters were really flocking to him. And then gradually evangelical leaders began to endorse him and eventually came around to supporting his candidacy. And now talk about him as the most pro-life president ever, or the most pro-religious freedom president ever. And so their coalescing around him has basically been complete, which is why you don't see very much pushback from them right now, even as the country is in free fall from both socially and economically from the pandemic.
Well, Sarah Poser, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Posner, who's a reporting fellow with Type Investigations, whose investigative reporting has appeared in Rolling Stone, Vice, The Nation, Mother Jones, The New Republic, Huffington Post, and Talking Points Memo. And she's the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. And her latest book just out is Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. Park and disappeared by half past.